From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, coup or no coup in Lesotho. Latest on West Africa's Ebola outbreak. UN says Islamic State committing crimes against humanity. Plus, Ukrainian separatists ready to discuss ceasefire. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Countries in southern Africa say they will send an observer team to Lesotho following an apparent coup attempt over the weekend. Officials from the Southern African Development Community made that announcement during an emergency meeting in Pretoria Monday with Lesotho Prime Minister Thomas Tabane and several other officials. Participants agreed on a timeline to end the suspension of parliament, a key demand of rival parties. Meantime, Prime Minister Tabane fled Lesotho on Saturday before the military surrounded his residence as well as that of a top police official. He went to neighboring South Africa saying there had been a coup and he feared for his life. We get more now from VOA's Anita Powell in Johannesburg.
Whatever happened Saturday in the tiny nation of Lesotho followed the script of a typical African coup d'etat, occurring just months after the Prime Minister dissolved parliament and a fragile coalition government fell apart. The government of neighboring South Africa reacted rapidly, saying, by all accounts, the activities of the Lesotho Defense Force thus far bear the hallmarks of a coup d'etat. But by Monday, no one was so sure. No new leader has emerged, and an army spokesman denied there was a coup attempt, saying the military was trying to prevent a police-backed protest scheduled for Monday from turning violent. The spokesman said soldiers had returned to their barracks. That protest against the Prime Minister was to be led by his deputy and political rival. The two have been locked in an uneasy coalition government since 2012. The deputy Prime Minister also denied the soldiers' actions amounted to a coup attempt. Whatever happened, talks involving the Southern African Development Community were underway Monday to try to patch things up. Lesotho Prime Minister Thomas Tabane and Deputy Prime Minister Motetra Metsing were both involved in the talks. An aide to Mr. Tabane said the Prime Minister had requested peacekeepers to be sent to Lesotho, a small mountain country encircled by South Africa. Southern Africa analyst Dimpo Motsamai of the Pretoria-based Institute of Security Studies predicted in July that a fallout between the parties seems imminent after the coalition broke down. She says what happened Saturday was not a coup.
Rather, it can be called actions of anarchy or actions that are of a treasonable nature. Basically, the commander of the Lesotho Defense Force, the Army Chief Tladika Modi, was fired on Friday. And he rejected this move of being fired by the country's Prime Minister, Thomas Tabane, who has fled the Maseru, fearing for his life over the weekend. And what had happened is that the soldiers that are aligned to the commander of the LDF raided several police stations over the weekend and also wanted to raid the residency of the Prime Minister and the reason why he has left the capital. And this was basically to intimidate the Prime Minister and try to force him to change the decision to fire him.
She says the actions were widely seen as a coup attempt because of Mr. Tabane's claim his life was under threat. But, she says, he has left out a big part of the story.
He's not talking about the reason why this is happening, which is the wider political context in the country to do with the collapse of the coalition government of which he's part of. And that is the real issue really at play and the reason why the insecurity and being perpetuated by the army chief is happening.
She says SADC will have to continue its mediation talks that started amid the coalition's collapse earlier this year. But she says the regional body has another mandate.
The second issue, though, which is much more primary, I think, and which needs to be established first before any dialogue can happen, is to re-establish the security in Maseru and to provide security and support to the Prime Minister so that he doesn't feel like his life is threatened when he goes back into the country. That will be important, of course, as a way of creating a conducive environment for any political dialogue to be facilitated by South Africa and by SADC.
It is not the first time Lesotho has suffered a political crisis. Since gaining independence from Britain in 1966, Lesotho has had several military coups, most recently in 1998. The nation is a constitutional monarchy in which the king's powers are largely ceremonial. Coup or no coup, one very worrying fact hangs over this tiny nation after this weekend's events. No one is in charge. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
U.S. military forces carried out an operation against al-Qaeda-linked al-Shabaab militants in Somalia on Monday, according to a Pentagon press secretary. Said the military is assessing the results of the operation and will provide additional information as and when appropriate. There were no further details immediately available. VOA's Somali service says their sources in Somalia are indicating there was a suspected drone attack targeting al-Shabaab vehicles in the lower Shabelle region. Witnesses who spoke to VOA on condition of anonymity said drones fired at least four missiles on al-Shabaab vehicles. The governor of Lower Shabelle region, Abdul Qadir Mohammed Noor, tells VOA's Somali service that al-Shabaab commanders were targeted. U.S. designated al-Shabaab as a foreign terrorist organization in 2008. In other news, Nigeria confirming a third case of Ebola there, bringing the total number of cases to 16, with around 200 people under observation. Onyebuchi Chukwu is the country's health minister.
One case of Ebola virus disease, a third degree contact, is being treated in Rivers State. Two other contacts of the late Port Harcourt doctor, that is, one of the doctors who managed him, and a pharmacy technician working for the doctor, are symptomatic. They are under quarantine.
Chukwu was speaking in Abuja on Monday, where he said 72 people in Lagos, where the virus were first detected, are being observed. Director of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Dr. Tom Frieden, expressed confidence on Monday in screening measures being put into place at International Airport in the Ghanaian capital, Conakry, to prevent the spread of Ebola.
The bottom line here is that the Ghanaian government and the airport's authority has set up a screening process that is going to make sure that no one with fever gets on a plane. And that's important. It gives the airlines confidence so they can keep flying. Because the airlines have to keep flying so we don't cut Guinea and West Africa off from the rest of the world. Doing that will be counterproductive. Countries might try to reduce travel in order to protect themselves, and it will do the opposite. If we cut off these countries, we will interfere with our ability to support them and stop the outbreak. And that will actually increase the risk to the rest of the world. We have to continue to support Guinea and West Africa and keep the flights going.
The Ebola outbreak ravaging West Africa began in Guinea. And the head of the World Bank, Jim Kunyem, writing, and Kim, that is, in a Washington Post newspaper editorial on Monday, denounced what he called the world's disastrously inadequate response to the West African Ebola outbreak. Ebola has killed more than 1,500 people, most of them in West Africa, since February, with more than 3,000 confirmed cases. World Health Organization is now turning its attention to Senegal, a tourist and transport hub, which reported its first case of Ebola on Friday. A Ghanaian man who came to stay with relatives near the capital, Dakar, last month. Kristen Roby reports now on public reaction.
At this busy market in Dakar, there has been a rush on bleach and soap. Some pharmacies in the capital are rationing hand sanitizer, one bottle per customer. Senegalese say they are taking preventative measures like hand washing seriously.
On a peur parce qu'on ne connaît pas cette maladie. C'est la première fois que l'on entend ça ici au Sénégal.
This man, Mohamed Sanya, says, I am scared because I don't know this disease and it is the first time in Senegal. And he says, now we are living with those diseased people, so this causes a big problem for authorities to help people to stay well. Along with concern has come some criticism that someone who knew he had been exposed to Ebola and was under health surveillance would travel to Senegal.
C'est une personne inconsciente. Parce que si c'était une personne qui réfléchissait.
Sanya says, very inconsiderate for him to expose the disease to Senegal. In a nearby supermarket, grocery clerk Awa Diop says since the announcement Friday, families have been clearing the shelves of disinfectants.
Oui, si. Non, mais là, c'est pas bon.
She says, yes, she's scared. She says, this disease is bad for your health. It's deadly. It's really not good. Senegal is the fifth West African country to be hit in the regional outbreak that began earlier this year in Guinea and has killed more than 1,500 people. Ebola has infected about twice as many. The 21-year-old man traveled overland in public transportation from his town in southern Guinea to Dakar 3 weeks ago. Ebola is spread through close contact with the bodily fluids of a sick person. It can take up to 3 weeks for symptoms to appear. The Senegalese government says it is monitoring people who may have been in contact with the man for signs of illness like fever or vomiting. They continue to search for others who may have been exposed. Senegal has closed its land borders with Guinea earlier, but had reopened it at the time the man crossed. The land borders were again shut on August 21st. Kristen Roby for VOA News, Dakar.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Pro-Russia rebels have made advances in Ukraine's east, pushing government forces back from an airport while representatives sat down for peace talks in Belarus. Authorities in Kiev accused Russian military, including tanks and artillery, of taking part in the attacks, a charge Moscow continues to dismiss. VOA's Daniel Scherf is following the story.
Ukrainian security authorities say a column of Russian tanks backed up separatist rebels in the east as they pushed government forces from Luhansk Airport. Ukraine National Security and Defense Council spokesman Colonel Andriy Lysenko says Ukrainian troops were forced to withdraw after coming under heavy fire. He says, judging from the precision of the strikes, the shelling was by professional artillerymen of the Russian Federation. Moreover, he says, Russian forces are concentrated around the nearby regional center of Lutygio and the approaches to the city of Shastia on the bank of Seversky-Donets River. The Ukrainian spokesman said no less than 1,600 Russian soldiers are operating inside Ukraine to support the rebels. Moscow says Kiev is claiming Russian troops are in Ukraine as an excuse to explain its recent military losses. The Ukraine spokesman acknowledged reports government troops were encircled in the town of Ilovaisk, but declined to give any details on casualties. A volunteer battalion commander was quoted in Ukrainian media saying several hundred were killed and others captured. The claim could not be independently verified. The European Union has given Moscow 1 week to reduce the tensions or face further sanctions. Russia's foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, repeated Moscow's position that it has never offered material support to the rebels. He dismissed Ukraine's demand the rebels first disarm and called again for an unconditional ceasefire. He says there will be no military intervention, and Russia supports only a peaceful resolution to this most difficult crisis and tragedy. Everything Russia does, he says, is aimed at promoting a political approach. But unfortunately, Lavrov says, Western countries are blind to the situation, and everything Kiev authorities declare and do receives support in the West. The losses follow missile strikes Sunday on two Ukrainian Coast Guard ships off the port of Mariupol. Authorities in Kiev say one Coast Guard cutter sank, but the number of casualties is not clear. The sinking marked the first rebel attack against ships at sea and raised further concerns that Mariupol could soon face an all-out assault. Meanwhile, peace talks continued in the Belarusian capital, Minsk. Pro-Russia rebels are seeking a special status for Ukraine's east that would give it great autonomy from Kiev. Donetsk rebel spokesman Andrei Pergin attended the meetings and said they brought an initial offer for consultations, followed by negotiations. He says at the moment it is just an exchange of documents and visions with the Ukrainian side to see where they can find common ground and a common direction. Ukraine was informally represented by former President Leonid Kuchma. Moscow's ambassador to Kiev and representatives of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe also took part in the talks. Daniel Scherf, VOA News, Kiev.
NATO Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen has announced a new very high readiness force in response to what he says is Russian aggression and intervention in Ukraine. He said in Brussels on Monday that the force would include several thousand troops ready to go where needed with very short notice. Van Rasmussen also said where they'll have air, sea, and special forces support. NATO leader also said that Ukraine's political leaders expect the Ukrainian parliament to abandon the country's non-aligned status after the October 26th election in a possible prelude to an application to join NATO.
I understand that the current political leadership in Kiev envisages that the new parliament, after the parliamentary elections in Ukraine, will change the legislation on non-alliance status. Now, we have to wait for elections. We have to wait for the legislative procedure in the new Ukrainian parliament.
Mr. Rasmussen added that Ukraine giving up its non-alliance status would allow the 28-member alliance and Kiev to start discussing the deepening of their relationship.
If the parliament passes a legislation that removes the non-alliance provision, then I would expect Ukraine to raise the issue with NATO within the NATO-Ukraine Commission. And based on that, Ukraine and NATO will then work out a plan for further development of the NATO-Ukraine partnership.
The NATO chief said, however, it was too early to say how long it might take for Ukraine to join the U.S.-led alliance. Ukraine said on Friday it would seek the protection of NATO membership after what Kiev and its Western allies say is the open participation of the Russian military in the war in Ukraine's eastern provinces. Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki vows the country will be a graveyard for the Islamic State group as he celebrated the liberation of a town from the militants. Mr. Maliki visited the newly freed town of Amirli on Monday, promising to reward Iraqi troops who took back from those he calls beasts and killers. Food, water, and medicine have been flowing into Amirli since Iraqi forces entered the town on Sunday. United Nations is calling for the international community to help protect Iraq's minorities against persecution by the militants from the Islamic State. UN officials say the group's widespread and systematic atrocities against ethnic and religious minorities are crimes against humanity. Lisa Schlein reports it is from an emergency session of the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva.
One-third of the UN Council's 44 member states must request a special session for it to be held. In this case, two-thirds of the members voted for the emergency debate on the situation in Iraq, indicating the depth of revulsion and concern evoked by the abuse being committed by the Islamist extremists, also known as ISIL. The United Nations says at least 850,000 people have fled from the Islamic State onslaught to Iraq's northern Kurdistan region. To highlight the dangers, the world body notes 180,000 Christians, Yazidis, and other ethnic and religious minorities in fear of their lives fled there on one day. UN Deputy High Commissioner for Human Rights Flavia Panzieri describes in painful detail the many violations being carried out by the militants, including targeted killings, forced conversions, abductions, slavery, sexual and physical abuse, and torture. She accuses the Islamists of ruthlessly carrying out what may amount to ethnic and religious cleansing in areas under their control. Panzieri says the effect of the conflict on the children of Iraq is catastrophic. She says many have been subject to physical and sexual abuse and forced by militants to join the fighting. She says these children will be scarred for life.
Families have reported forced recruitment by ISIL of boys as young as 15. Some of these boys, who subsequently managed to escape, told their families that they had been positioned on front lines during military operation to shield ISIL fighters. Others said that they had been forced to donate blood for treatment of injured fighters. child soldiers have been posted at illegal checkpoints set up by ISIL and also by other armed groups operating in Baghdad and other areas.
UN official Shaloka Bayani says Islamic State is also attacking structures of cultural or religious significance. He says the group is trying to erase thousands of years of cultural and religious heritage by bulldozing or blowing up mosques, shrines, and other places of worship. Bayani also expresses concern about reports of human rights violations being committed by Iraqi security forces that he says may amount to war crimes.
Information received also alleges that the Iraq security forces have also been involved in severe grave violations of the right to life in the context of the recent events, including shelling of civilian areas, causing multiple deaths and injury, and the killing of detainees. All actors must abide by international law and must be held accountable for the crimes committed.
UN officials say anyone guilty of crimes against humanity or war crimes must be held accountable. A resolution before the UN Rights Council calls upon the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights to urgently dispatch a mission to investigate alleged violations and abuses of international human rights law committed by the Islamic State and other terrorist groups. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Britain's Prime Minister on Monday unveiled a new package of legislation aimed at preventing attacks by Islamist militants returning to England from the Middle East. David Cameron said the new measures would be put to empower police to temporarily seize passports at UK borders of Britons suspected to be traveling abroad to fight with militant groups.
We have already taken a wide range of measures, including stopping suspects from traveling to the region by seizing passports, barring foreign nationals from re-entering the United Kingdom, legislating so that we can prosecute people for all terrorist activity, even where that activity takes place overseas, and bringing forward emergency legislation, for instance, to safeguard our use of communications data. We've also stepped up our operational response with a five-fold increase in Syria-related arrests, the removal of 28,000 pieces of extremist material from the internet this year alone, including 46 ISIL-related videos. But I've said all along there should not be a knee-jerk reaction or the introduction of sweeping new blanket powers that would ultimately be ineffective. That is not what those who work so hard to keep us safe actually want. They want a targeted approach that reflects a forensic focus on the threat we face and that protects their operational independence and decision-making.
The move comes after Prime Minister Cameron pledged to plug gaps in Britain's defenses, describing the extremist threat posed by the Islamic State group, which he called ISIL, as being more dangerous than even Al-Qaeda.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
And now a couple of stories from the world of sports. Six-time Olympic sprint champion Usain Bolt of Jamaica is in China on a promotional tour. It's for next year's IAAF World Championships. During a stop in Shanghai, Bolt was asked by reporters about his world-breaking race at the 2008 Beijing Olympics.
It's something you can't forget. It was one of my first greatest moments, and it was that's where it begins for me. And I can remember everything that happened. I've watched races many times, so for me, it's always been a big moment, and I'm looking forward to coming back next year and competing again in the business.
Yes, next year the Track and Field World Championship will be held in Beijing's National Stadium, also known as the Bird's Nest, from August the 22nd to 30th, all of that in 2015. At the U.S. Open Tennis Tournament in New York, five-time champion Serena Williams reached her first Grand Slam quarterfinal of 2014 on Monday by an overwhelming victory. A 50th-ranked Kasia Kanepi of Estonia, she took her 6-3, 6-3. And for the men, Andy Murray pulled out a win, beating Joe Wilfried Tsonga in three sets, 7-5, 7-5, and then 6-4. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. It's always good to have you with us. A reminder, the top world news is just moments away. We hope that you will stay tuned for that. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Dave Magnus, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Tuesday.
This is Today in History. On September 2nd, 1666, the Great Fire of London broke out. When the blaze was finally extinguished, 4 days later, more than 80% of the city had been destroyed. Tens of thousands of people were made homeless, but amazingly, few were killed. In 1789, an act of the U.S. Congress created the Department of the Treasury to manage the revenue of the United States government. The department produces paper currency and coins for circulation. It also collects federal taxes. In 1859, a huge solar storm affected telegraph service in the U.S. A similar storm today would have a catastrophic effect on broadcast and internet communications. On this day in 1945, Japan formally surrendered to Allied forces, ending World War II. U.S. Army General Douglas MacArthur presided over the surrender ceremony aboard the battleship USS Missouri, which was anchored in Tokyo Bay. MacArthur was appointed by President Truman to oversee the Allied occupation of post-war Japan. Hours after Japan's surrender, Vietnamese communist leader Ho Chi Minh declared his country's independence from France, but it would take 30 more years for a unified communist Vietnam to become a reality. By the way, Ho Chi Minh also died on this date 24 years later in 1969. In 1792, during the September massacres of the French Revolution, rampaging mobs slaughtered three Roman Catholic bishops, more than 200 priests, and prisoners believed to be royalist sympathizers. Many men, women, and children were slaughtered in the September massacres. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Less than 3 years ago, on October 23, 2011, Libyans celebrated the country's liberation from longtime dictator Muammar Gaddafi. A broad coalition of groups composed of people from all walks of life banded together, disregarding regional, religious, tribal, ethnic, and political differences, to rid the nation of a brutal regime. After months of fighting and the loss of too many lives, a bright new future finally seemed within reach of the people of Libya. Unfortunately, it would not be that easy. Rival groups that had united to defeat a common enemy soon turned on each other and began to fight in earnest to further their narrow agendas. Still, despite the upheaval, the country seemed to be moving forward, holding general elections in July 2012 and another one in June 2014 for a new House of Representatives that was seated in August. Since May, the three-year-long upward spiral of violence escalated. In Benghazi, assassinations and attacks on government forces continued in the wake of former Libyan National Army commander Khalifa Haftar's attacks on Islamic extremists, which he then declared part of a broader campaign against all Islamists in Libya, whom he likened to flesh-eating microbes in a May 20th interview. In mid-July, rival militias began a battle for control of Tripoli International Airport. After 5 weeks of fighting, hundreds of deaths, and millions of dollars worth of damage to Libya's infrastructure, the Operation Dawn affiliates gained control of the airport. These Operation Dawn affiliates then proceeded to declare a new government, a move denounced by the country's official government. And the fighting continues. In a joint statement, the governments of the United States, France, Germany, Britain, and Italy strongly condemned the escalation of fighting and violence in and around Tripoli, Benghazi, and across Libya. The five countries called on all parties in Libya, including the government and all militias, to accept an immediate ceasefire, engage constructively in the democratic process, and to stop all activities that risk undermining it. "We support the efforts of the UN support mission in Libya in this regard," said the statement. We call on Libya's interim government and the elected House of Representatives to adopt inclusive policies that benefit all Libyans and to build a government that meets the Libyan people's needs for security, reconciliation,